be final entity in Carolina in the morning.
In Carolina.
No one would be sweeter than McCready when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Joe Simpson with the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life in earlier times around North Carolina's Triangle area, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll finish reading excerpts from Charles B. Stanley's book, West Hillsboro Origins, Stories and Poems by a Native Son. Perception sometimes only reveals one dimension. I find myself going down the steps of my home on Allen Ruffin Avenue in West Hillsboro. It's October 1959, and I have just come home from Appalachian State for the weekend. Walking north, I'm going to visit my pal, Joe Dickey. He lives at the end of the street in a yellow cinder block house. On the left, I pass Mrs. Sadie Riley's house and wave, seeing her in her rocker on the front porch. I still remember her saying that she would be praying for me in college. I pass Jim Fawcett's house next and remember the boxing matches Dad and I used to watch there. There is a bottom on the right where a huge poplar tree towers above. From the road, I can hear the trickling stream where a bunch of us kids used to dam up and launch pine bark boats by breaking the dam and follow them all the way to the drain pipe under the railroad. I don't remember following my boat all the way to the Eno. Maybe I did. The road is dusty, even on October. It still is a while before it's paved. Adrian Burton's house is next on the right. He and I entered West Hillsboro Elementary at the same time. Mrs. Pruitt's house sits solitary on the left side of the road. Then I see him, walking down Ruffin, headed straight toward me. It's Ernest Medlin. I have a great respect for the Medlin family. Mom was married to Lillard Medlin, and after his death, she married my father, Charles B. Stanley, Sr. From my later research, a good number of the Medlins came from Lincoln County. I think there were 13 children in Lillard's family, and he was one of the younger ones. Well, getting back to Ernest. He keeps getting closer and closer. Way down deep, I know what he's going to ask. Okay, it's coming. You going to college? Yes, sir. You playing football? No, sir. Then why are you going to college? I realized then, on that cool, crisp October day, that people had a specific image of me that didn't reflect the total person. Maybe we all too often present one dimension to some and more of ourselves to others. So much for philosophy. Ernest went on his way, and I stood there looking down at my shoes, wondering what I could have said. I could have remarked that I had a part in a Greek tragedy. I played Orestes in the play Iphigenia in Tauris. I still have the script after all these years. I don't think that explanation would have had a real effect on Ernest. Or would it? Hot Dog on the Highway. I returned to Hillsboro as a young adult, married to my high school sweetheart, and with my young daughter Carol. Adventures from the road did not end. Kids were coming from everywhere while I was looking out of my picture window at my home in the Colonial Hills Division in Hillsboro. Our house was located adjacent to Interstate 85. There was an old song about the railroad running through the middle of the house. In my case, it was the highway. The kids were all shouting and pointing to something out on the road. Partially hidden behind the trees, it looked like a truck had broken down, with the middle almost touching the ground. Daughter Carol practically fell in the door, exclaiming, "Dad, it's the Oscar Mayer Wienermobile!" We lived in that house for 13 years, and only once did someone from the highway approach us for assistance. Well, this was the once. The driver knocked on my door and asked if he could use our phone. This was a few years before the cell phone era. We ushered the somewhat exasperated gentleman in and offered him some iced tea. He thanked us for our hospitality and then went to the phone. The communicated conversation was one that has lingered with me since that late 1960s day. While calling for mechanical assistance, the person on the other end of the line asked the questions that each of us would have if we had been in his position. Could you give me a description of your vehicle so that I can send someone out to assist you? The driver promptly replied, "You can't miss it. It's a 40-foot-long hot dog." Way down deep, I wanted to ask, "Wouldn't it have gone all the way without onions?" The last time that I saw the intriguing vehicle, we were in the parking lot of the Grand Ole Opry in Nashville, Tennessee. Carol was a teenager, and I asked if she still remembered the Colonial Hills hot dog experience. Some things you never forget. Fast forward to the present. Earlier in this narrative, I referred to the top of Okinichi Mountain as a place I could observe the origins of the 7 decades of life on this planet. Mine, that is. In early spring of 2010, the Okinichi Mountain State Natural Area sponsored a geological hike. Grandson Nicholas and his mother, Laura, accompanied me on that warm Saturday morning. The geologist was very informative in pointing out the pyrophyllite outcrops along the trail. He explained that was the reason for the now sheer cliff overlooking the Eno River. The mineral was mined in the early 1920s and was used to make fireproof brick for furnaces. He remarked that some was incorporated onto the nose cone of the NASA space shuttle. It is a rare mineral found in few places on Earth. Okay, back to the story. After following the professor down the old path on the south side of the precipice, we left the group and climbed up the very steep north side. Laura was concerned about me because I had a defibrillator implant to assist with controlling atrial fibrillation. About halfway up, I remembered that there is now a path with steps leading up to the top. However, I wasn't going to turn around and go back down to find it. Upon reaching the top and looking across the West Hillsboro landscape, I could see the home in which I grew up, Eno United Methodist Church, where I was married, Betty Riley's store, the location of my elementary school, and, of course, the railroad. Suddenly, I felt a blow to my chest, and my knees buckled. Someone said, "As you're dying, your life passes before you." Actually, before me, in a wonderful wide vista, the places of the first years of my life literally appeared. Later, I found out that my pulse rate had risen to an alarming rate, and the defibrillator shocked my heart back to normal. You could imagine how Laura and Nicholas felt when I screamed. "Grandpa, please tell that story many times." When I was about 6 years old, living behind Eno Methodist Church, Mama sent me to Betty Riley's store to get some butter. There was a little path behind the church, which continued toward the store. As I turned the corner of the church, I saw a group of men, probably 4 or 5, sitting on crates outside Paul Riley's fish market. I had to pass right by them. As I got closer, I could tell that they were laughing and talking. Just as I came by them, I heard a harsh sound. "Come here, boy." I walked over, and I think it was one of the Adams brothers who said, "Boy, I'm going to cut your ears off." I turned and ran as fast as I could to Betty Riley's store. You know, I don't remember getting the butter, because I knew I had to go back past that group. When I finally got up my nerve, I walked back. But this time, I distanced myself by walking on the far side of the road across from the store. I will never forget the laughter from those men. Suddenly I heard, "Come back here, boy. I'm going to cut your ears off now." I ran so fast I could feel the wind rushing past the ears that I hoped to keep. I don't remember what happened when I got home, but after 70 years, I can still hear the voice of the Adams man. "Come here, boy. I'm going to cut your ears off." Bicycles mean freedom. While sitting by my computer one morning a few years ago, I looked out the window and saw grandsons Nicholas and Lucas riding their bikes around our house. They live across the street. It was 7:15 a.m., and I thought that was pretty early to be riding before going to school. I wondered if I ever rode my bike that early in the morning. Then some early riding adventures came to mind. My worst Christmas day in memory was a white one. Imagine getting the greatest present Santa could possibly have brought, a brand new bike. I was devastated that he just had to have snow on the ground so the reindeer could easily pull the sleigh. You know, we seldom have white Christmases. I never could figure why the sleigh needed skids if the reindeer could fly. Well, anyway, I can still picture sitting on our screened-in back porch, looking out at Eno Church in the middle of a whiteout. The church was white, our house was white, and 3 feet of white fluffy misery came between extreme happiness and deep depression. I was sitting on that bike and riding all over the neighborhood in my mind. After seeming like an eternity, the snow finally departed. I don't know why I had such a big bike. Maybe I was just a little kid. To get on it, I leaned up against a bank between Sadie Riley's and Jim Fawcett's houses. I got up on the bank and sort of halfway leapt from it to the seat of the bike. You know, like Hopalong Cassidy did on his horse Topper. The main problem with that effort was that Topper had 4 legs and my bike only 2 wheels. Talk about skinned shins and a bruised ego. Finally, I had broken in my steed and immediately named it Silver, even though it was red. I'm sure that Clayton Moore of Lone Ranger fame would have been proud. I wonder if my West Hillsboro neighbors questioned my sanity when they saw me flashing down West Hill Avenue by Cole and Riley's store toward the railroad track, shouting at the top of my lungs, "Hi-ho, Silver! Away!" When I was in the 7th grade, I rode my bike 2 miles to school. During free time after lunch, while playing on the rocky outcrop near where the new gym now stands, I fell head over heels down the steep embankment. Stunned and in pain, I came to the realization that I had torn a big hole in the knee of my new jeans that Mom had just bought me in Durham. Then I saw the real damage. My knee was badly cut from the sharp rocks. If it had been today, I would certainly have gotten stitches. I don't even remember telling my teacher about it. I guess I must have washed off the injury, but I also don't remember that. What I do remember is when I got on my bike after school, I couldn't ride it home, because when I bent my knee, blood began to flow from the open wound. So I pushed the bicycle the 2 miles home. About 10 years ago, I was showing the spot to my 2 grandsons. Lucas stepped carefully down the rocky surface and looked back up at me. He said, "Grandpa, I see some stains on the rocks here. I'll bet they came from you." I didn't have the heart to tell him that after 60-plus years, they probably had washed away. They certainly haven't been washed away from my memory. Another bicycle mishap I recall was when I turned right toward the front of Eno Church. Walking toward me was Yance Riley. Mr. Yance continued toward me, and I just knew he would move out of the way. Well, he didn't, and I drove my bike up his pants leg. He shouted at me with some very strong language. You probably would have, too. After grandson Lucas heard of my experience, he asked just what Mr. Riley had said. I replied, "Hot dang, you all, I swear." That wasn't exactly how it was, but it was good enough for Lucas. Have we ever really thought about how those early bicycles made our world become a larger and more interesting place? I continued to enjoy riding bicycles after I grew up and had my own children. My daughter Laura and I made frequent treks near our home in Alamance County. We sometimes took the back roads all the way to Hillsboro. A streak of blue. A streak of blue with wistful blonde hair blowing in the breeze became a young girl perched upon her bicycle, pedaling with such grace and ease. To ride in a car would be much easier, she thought as she traveled on morn, but never would I see the tiny shrew or hear the wind blow through the corn. Even though her legs grew tired, she still traveled on, stopping at man's grocery, and then turned back toward home. A small calf watched her as she went by, grazing in the meadow under a beautiful blue sky. Passing motorists returned her wave, bathed in the sunset glow, adding a touch of happiness to the traffic flow. Her mother joyfully smiled, her dog happily barked, the kitty mewed and mewed as the blue bike was parked.
With your eyes blue.
Trees are made for people like me. Joyce Kilmer wrote, "I think I shall never see a poem lovely as a tree." For years, I thought the most interesting part about that was that Joyce Kilmer was a guy. As time passed, however, I began to realize just how important trees have been. We had a cherry tree in our front yard in West Hillsboro, and I would climb to the top of it. On a day with a stiff breeze, one would get a really good ride. From the top of that tree, I could see a good deal of my neighborhood. Looking down the hill to the east, I could see Alec Riley's store building. I always thought it was interesting that the little branch ran directly under it. Did it ever rain enough to flood the store? Oh, that store is where I used to get those delicious candy orange slices. The tree also gave me a view of Jones Avenue that went up the hill from Eno Street to our elementary school. Mr. Ben Terrell used to have a little store on the left side about halfway up the hill. It was within walking distance to school. Actually, everything was within walking distance. There used to be a teacher who sometimes, after lunch, would send a student down to Mr. Terrell's store to get a package of BC powder. I guess teaching then was as stressful as it is today. She had to take a BC to help her get through the rest of the day. Another favorite tree of mine was the apple tree out behind Eno United Methodist Church. I remember climbing it and dropping bombs on the enemy below. I'm sure that was at the end of World War II. I was thinking that children don't climb trees as much today, but I can picture daughter Laura and her cousin Jason Coleman perched in a little dogwood in Bryant Pa Brewer's yard in Fairview. Linda remembers our two grandsons scampering up a tree at the Woods family beach house. Joyce Kilmer said in Trees that poems are made by fools like me and that only God can make a tree. I just hope he makes some more accessible for the kids of today. Reconnecting with old friends is important. A few years back, I included some of these ponderings and reminiscing in the news of Orange County. It was a great experience because I reconnected with a lot of old friends. Here's a column from October 2012. John Horn and I were good friends in high school. While thinking about some of our adventures, mostly involving his old Chevrolet, it dawned on me that there were several holes in my memory. It was more than 50 years ago. Maybe I earned those lapses. So I remember being out on old NC-86, somewhere between Hillsboro and Chapel Hill. John's car had broken down, and I can still see moonlight reflecting off the winding road as a whole carload of us teenagers were meandering toward nowhere. So what happened after that? John now lives in Burlington. We actually haven't seen each other in 50-plus years, so I gave him a call today and asked how we got out of that particular predicament. We had a great reunion over the phone. John thinks we made our way to Glenn and Don Collins' house, and they helped us get back home. The Collins family owned a dairy farm out on 86. I remember another time when his headlights went out and really messed up an evening of planned merriment. The most trouble we got into was not because the car malfunctioned, but one day when it performed perfectly. My senior year at Hillsboro High School included two study halls after lunch. One day, John suggested that we go home. Since I had no afternoon classes, his suggestion seemed very reasonable. He was parked right in front of the school. We got in and pulled out of the spot. As we drove away, I thought, what a great idea. Now, Mr. Childress, the school janitor, did his job by going to Mr. Grady Brown, who was our principal, and immediately reporting the skipping incident. The resulting penalty was that we could not return to school unless accompanied by a parent. One could imagine how embarrassed my mom was. John relayed to me on the phone that his punishment continued when his father addressed his backside when he finally got home. I don't remember a similar disciplinary action, but I think some of my family thought it was kind of funny. Not me. Looking back at the 1957 football season, John Horn completed 2 passes out of 7 attempts. The interesting part of that stat is that both completions were for touchdowns. John, you did well. Some of you had great friends while in high school and have never seen or contacted them since. Do a good deed for them and yourself. Give them a call. And plan on going to your next reunion. Another article from October 2012 had a similar theme of holes in memories and reconnecting with people from our past. Coland Riley, a staple in the community. Do you remember where you first pumped gas into your car? How about the first time you heard of a bomb shelter? Many questions of my past are full of blanks when trying to fill in the empty spaces. Some come back rather vividly. My family mostly frequented Colin's and Betty Riley's stores. What I remember about him was that the store is the only place I ever saw him and his wife, Blanche. In my early years, and even later, he was always there. I guess we all look for constants in our lives, especially today. Just think, that was years before the supermarkets and big box stores. I wanted more information regarding Colin. Did he have the first gas pump in West Hillsboro? Did he really have a bomb shelter under his house? I called my friend Butch Rayner, who later ran a convenience store just north on West Hill Avenue, and posed those questions to him. Now, Butch is a legend in his own time, and has bountiful knowledge of his neighborhood. I asked whatever happened to Doris, Colin's daughter. Butch replied, she lives up there in Alamance County near you somewhere. In about 5 minutes of research, the internet is awesome, I located Doris, who actually lives about a half a mile away. We had a great conversation. She thinks the first gas pump in West Hillsboro was at her grandfather Alec Riley's store. I could see the store building from the top of my front yard cherry tree. She also concurred that the little stream did run directly under the store. She remembers that she and her cousin, Danny Ray Melton, looked for crawfish under rocks there. Just think, about 200 yards west, I was doing the same thing under the big poplar tree across the road from Jim Fawcett's house. I wonder if she ever saw my bark boats floating by. I wonder if children today look for crawfish in nearby streams. Just turning over a rock and waiting for the water to clear was an adventure in itself. There he would be, with those pinchers ready to take on the giant foe who had invaded his domain. You had to be careful and pick him up behind those pinchers, or you could get a painful pinch. Colin Riley was probably the first businessman I ever knew. When Cone Mill sold the houses of the mill village, he bought several and used them for rental property. And yes, according to Butch, Doris, Reggie, Vic, and others, he did have a bomb shelter filled with food and water. He was a survivalist during the Cold War that, thank goodness, never became hot. It seems that every time I turn around, I run into a former Hillsboro or Orange County friend here in Alamance County. Actually, Alamance County was formed out of Orange County in 1849, according to Dr. Powell's Encyclopedia of North Carolina. I guess we kind of just spilled over into what was ours up until that date. Reggie Vick, Ann Craven, Brent Wilder, and Doris Riley are just a few transplants. To me, the most amazing fact is that, while waiting in line to pick up grandson Nicholas at Southern Alamance Middle School, two cars behind me, I could find a couple who entered West Hillsboro Elementary School the same time I did, James and June Taylor, awaiting their middle school grandson. Well, there's more. Barbara Davis, Grady Brown's niece, lived within a half a mile and attended the same church as Linda and I do. Ward Parker is found there also on Sundays. John Horn and I communicate occasionally. Clem Johnson lives in Graham. Peggy Minnis Brown, Harry Neal Brown, and Linda's sister Harriet Brewer also relocated here. I'm sure there are more, and if any of you didn't want to be found, I express my sincere apologies. Remembering the sounds of Hillsboro West. There are many sounds that take us back years to the places of our younger times. Waking up in the morning or going to sleep at night to the gentle rain on our tin roof is certainly one. The pounding, earth-shaking vibrations of passing trains will always be a part of us. Living about a half mile from the Eno Cotton Mill brought the abrupt sound from the weave room when someone opened an outside door. Equally shattering was the sudden silence when that door was closed. Church bells on Sunday morning brought sounds all so familiar as to the direction of our life's journeys. Some of us never thought we had a choice but to go, the same as the school bells, each reminding us that there was something above and beyond us. The sound of bare feet crossing the river bridge near the mill, and the voice of the Eno as it passed over the dam below, are part of our tapestry. Somebody's rooster crowing, a whippoorwill giving a lonely cry, and a bobwhite's pleasant call. When was the last time you heard any of those? They are all etched in our minds. How familiar were the sounds of play? a bat connecting with a ball bouncing off the roof of the church or against the brick foundation, the oomph sound of someone being tackled on the church lawn on a cool autumn afternoon, and the sound of tennis shoes hitting the cold pavement while a group of teenagers were playing football, awaiting the school bus at Brooks' store on a frigid January morning. Probably the best sound was Mom calling for us to come in to supper. That happened every evening from the mountain village to the old and new hill and down to Monkey Bottom. The sounds, smells, people, and experiences that shaped me have inspired a lot of pondering over these 77 years. I've often taken to the page to attempt to put into words feelings that were inspired by my beginnings in West Hillsboro, college, family, and beyond.
Just a dream of sunset in the
fair. The Caboose. As we approach the end of this collection of thoughts and stories, I'm reminded of the disappearing caboose. One of the simple joys of my childhood was to listen for the train, and when I heard its distant rumble, I would tear out my back door and head for the Eno United Methodist Churchyard. There, while standing fewer than 100 yards from the train, I would wave at the engineer and start counting. The most cars I ever counted was probably about 180. That was a lot of America moving. At the rear of the train was the caboose. I waved, and the railroad men riding in it waved back. I then hurried home, leaping over the hedge bordering the church parsonage. You know, I miss that caboose. One of the first songs I sang in elementary school ended like this. Little red caboose going down the track, little red caboose behind the train. I guess children don't sing that anymore, because it isn't there. There's something wrong when trains have no end to them. The caboose always gave a punctuation mark to the train's journey when it passed before my eyes. Now it always looks like something is missing. In fact, if you observe closely, there are hoses and all kinds of couplings hanging out behind the final car. Oh, you can find cabooses now if you look for them. Usually they're located in city parks, or sometimes, like in Burlington, you can find one downtown across the tracks from the new depot. Children love to clamber up on them, and there seems to be some kind of magnetism between the two. Maybe it's the thrill of being on a real train. Probably most kids have never ridden on a train, or seen a little red caboose behind one. Hang in there, caboose. There are some of us that hope to see you giving finality to every passing freight. Trains, like most of the stories we like, should have happy endings. After hitching a ride on a freight through Glacier National Park and falling off of it in Minot, North Dakota, I somehow had a happy ending, and the last thing I saw was the little red caboose going out of sight. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Following the broadcast, it's readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long, until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138.